Welcome to News Talk, and this is D.G. Martin. And my guest is Elaine Neal Orr, who is a professor at North Carolina State University and the author of a lot of books. The latest one is called Swimming Between Worlds. It's her second novel and a very interesting and powerful book. Elaine Orr, welcome.
Thank you, D.G. Glad to be here.
Tell us about your new book.
Oh, my. Well, the book is set in Winston-Salem. In 1959 to 60, it takes about a year, but it has backstory in other places, including Nigeria. That's the primary backstory where I grew up. I wanted to write an American novel, and I thought, where am I going to set it? And the first thought that came to my mind was Winston-Salem, because I had had one happy year there as a girl. And so I set about just to see what had happened in Winston-Salem that year and did a Google search. And the first thing that came up was the lunch counter sit-ins at Woolworths. So what I knew from the beginning was that I would have the setting in Winston-Salem. I thought I would have someone living in the house we'd lived in. And I just conjured.
In the house you really lived
Yes,
in.
We really lived in this house at Jarvis and West End Boulevard. And I conjured this young male architect who'd gone to State College, School of Architecture, in the 50s, and he became the primary character. And then a young woman appeared in the story from Winston-Salem, and a young white woman and a young African-American man. And the story revolves around the civil rights movement. Or I should say that's the catalyst for some of the primary action of the novel. But all three of these characters are in their 20s, and they're searching for their destinies. And I don't really think it's a coming-of-age novel so much as it's a kind of search for place, belonging, the central values or beliefs that we carry into our young that are formulated maybe by the time we are in our mid-20s.
I love this.
I'm
writing about your book. I'm using the term coming of age, and you're right. It's not the right term. It focuses back on current times where we realize that the so-called coming of age occurs maybe not in the late teenage years, but it occurs after somebody's out of college and roaming around and trying to find their place, his or her place in this world. And I don't know what the term for it is, but that's what your book is.
We'll have to come up with a term and begin to use it, because it's really more about being challenged as a young adult and then deciding if one is going to take the route that's been set out for you, or whether you're going to take a more difficult road. No.
Well, you've got two settings. You've got the principal setting in is Winston-Salem, where and in the context of changing attitudes about our segregated past and the forcefulness that the sit-in movements in that time brought all over North Carolina. But the story kind of starts in Nigeria.
Well, is it called the preface or the prelude? I can't remember those, which when it is.
You should read this book.
I should read this book. But there's a very brief little moment where we're in Nigeria with Thacker Hart, and that's probably 1957 when he's there. He's there on a mission. It's not a religious or spiritual mission. It's a secular one to help this emerging new nation create a paradigm for high schools, or a model for building high schools across the country. And so it's just a little teeny moment. But then we go to 1959, and he's back in the U.S. He's been dismissed from this prestigious assignment. And it's the first time he's ever in his life experienced shame.
Any kind of failure. Hard for all of us when that moment comes
exactly.
to all of us. It's not easy to deal with. Well, I think the intriguing thing for me in that situation was how he came to be shamed, how he came to be to lose his position. And I thought that was where you really took off. That was what you cared about. Excuse me for taking over this program. This is your program.
But, no, I'm intrigued to hear what you're
well, but,
thinking.
You love your Nigerian roots.
Right.
And what happened to him is as you describe it, is, but it, you tantalize us along. You don't tell us all this
right.
at the beginning.
We know that he's lost the job. We don't know why.
And then let's see if I can summarize and then have you – if you'll – supplement.
Sure.
The summary is that he fell in love with Nigerian culture so much that his bosses thought he was unreliable.
I mean, exactly.
That he'd gone off the deep end. And,
right. It used to be called going native.
Yeah.
Maybe still is. And
so I said,
yeah.
Elaine did this too.
Right, exactly. Everyone should. Well, if you go to another country, you should.
Yeah.
Right, that's why you go. You don't go to remain an American, a conspicuous American. Right. And so what he does is not, doesn't seem that radical to us now. But then, right, he was sent to be an ambassador of American values and ways of thinking. But he starts designing round houses instead of square ones. And he attends sort of what would be thought of then sort of native rituals. And he becomes acquainted with a native priestess. And A native priestess. The character at the Ocean River, right? The Sacred Forest. She's European, but that makes it kind of even more complex.
Wait a minute. There's a white German. Is she German?
Right. And German, she's Austrian, and she's...
And she's a native priest, so she's really turned to native.
Oh, yes. I mean, she's entirely, to use the term, gone native. But she's also completely normal, right? Tacker meets her. She lives in a lovely house by the river. She's adopted these Nigerian children. She's creating art. She's completely reliable.
She's gone off the deep end.
Oh.
I mean, she's dangerous. I mean, I'm putting myself—
In the position of the American
this is inside
institution.
Talk. So
yes.
I'm going to bring anybody who's listening who hadn't given up on me. But we're talking about Nigeria and a white European woman who's become kind of a priestess,
right?
Who has not seduced, but it's not the right word, but has brought our male North Carolina, Winston-Salem, North Carolina architect into her fold, and it's resulted in him losing his job
right.
because he's
right.
Not because he's attached to blacks, but he's attached to this white witch person
right,
in
exactly.
Nigeria.
Exactly. Right. Do I tell you that she's based on a real woman?
Yes.
She's based on a real woman. There's an Austrian-German woman who went to Nigeria in 1949 with her German husband, who was a professor at the University of Ibadan, which for our listeners— was the first Nigerian university. It was based on the British model, and it's where Tacker Hart goes to help
the fictional
character. And the first outing, really, that he takes with his Nigerian colleagues is to the sacred forest of the Oshun River. And he meets this woman who is a real woman, except her name is Suzanne Winger.
Well.
She's a world known artist.
Well, this is interesting because I thought you, I didn't come here to criticize your book. I came here to talk about all the good things, but I thought you gave her short shrift.
Interesting.
I got interested in her, and you told me about how the things that she did and what she believed and how beautiful she was, and that she put some kind of tattoo on our hero. demonstrated that he'd gone over the hill, and so that can be a story for your next book. I got to stop interrupting you.
Oh, no,
so
no.
We're going to take a break.
Okay.
And come back and continue to talk with Elaine Neal Orr about her new book, Swimming Between Worlds. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Elaine Neal Orr about her new she's a professor at North Carolina State University. We're talking about her second novel, Swimming Between Worlds. And this novel, like her earlier novel, is set partly in the southern United States and partly in Nigeria, where the two places where she grew up.
Yes, that's right.
So where were we?
We were talking about Suzanne Winger, but actually she's called – oh, now I can't remember. Becker, Anna Becker. She's Anna Becker in
Anna
the
Becker.
Novel. Yes. And
– one of the very interesting characters in your novel, and you were telling us about her. Is there anything more to say about her?
Well,
white witch in Nigeria?
Right. You know, we would actually go as young missionary kids to see her work in the at the forest. And so I grew up with her being a part of the environment that
but
I grew up with.
But she was a rival for your parents' missionary work,
well,
wasn't she?
One would think so, because she was revitalizing the Yoruba religion. And nonetheless, we all went out there and walked across the swinging bridge and saw her work. And yes, I think that as a young girl, I was probably thought to think she was, you know, she was odd. My American missionary,
interesting
but odd.
Your parents are tolerant of all, to all kinds of things. And
right.
So go learn about it.
But, right. And she was much admired.
And what is the Yoruba? Is that right?
Well, I say Yoruba, but that may be
whatever
my religion. I don't know.
There is in this group, in this part of Nigeria, is it a do they solicit are they evangelical like your
Would say probably not.
They just do
no,
it.
No, it's just the traditional religion of the area. And the thing about the Oshun River is that it's a it brings fertility to anyone who bathes in it. And so when the young men, when the men, the Nigerian men take tack or swimming, you know, they say this is going to make you potent, more potent, and bless your mother in the United States. And he's only half listening because he's worried that if he gets in this body of water, he's going to get this awful tropical disease called schistosomiasis. And I don't use the word. It's too hard for him to remember that. He just knows he's promised not to get in any bodies
of
water.
Well, you must have had these complex feelings when you went swimming in the river, too.
Well, I didn't swim in that river.
You all had your own river.
We had a crystal clear river else in another town
and
that we swam in.
And did you worship the
I worshiped all the rivers, I think, as a girl. That's why I'm such an odd duck. DG, you know, and why I sort of belong to both of these places and maybe none of them. I'm just this somewhat displaced person. I don't know. Isn't that the name of one of Flannery O'Connor's stories?
Well, this is interesting. And for anybody joining us late, we're talking about Elaine Orr's latest novel, Swimming Between Two Worlds. And she's become, in both of her novels and also in one or two of her other nonfiction books, explaining to us how it was to have feet in southern United States and in Nigeria. And so this is like a show where I'm showing you off because you're an unusual.
I'm certainly an unusual breed.
Unusual.
There aren't
background.
That many people writing about southern Nigeria and the southern U.S., which is
right.
What that's my niche.
Yeah. So you're telling us about that. And there are all kinds of things more to tell, I think, in terms – and I'm interested in religion, so the complex interrelationship of American – of deeply religious American people who become familiar with, respectful of, and then sometimes kind of go over the – sometimes say, well, this stuff is better than my stuff.
Right. That, well, you know, Tacker
This is your main character in the novel.
Yeah, Tacker Hart, the main character, the character who – there are two point of view characters, Tacker and Kate. And his story is the one, as you've perceived, that was the first. In other words, the idea that there would be this young white man who's the town hero, right? He played football. He was a good scholar. He was a nice guy. He was like you, DG. Everyone loved him. And – he's on the road to great success as a young architect. But he goes to Nigeria, and instead of encountering the dark continent, he encounters a country full of light. And the men he encounters are they're smart. They're better athletes than he is. They do math in their head faster than he can do it on paper. But mostly they draw him in and they treat him as an equal. And when he gets back to the U.S. and he encounters, again, the Jim Crow South, it just doesn't work. It just doesn't. Now, he can't make just slip back in and say, okay, everything should be different, because he sees that Nigerian men are not exactly the same as African American men, but still, this injustice in his own country based on color. When in Nigeria, he encountered nothing based on color. There is no color in Nigeria. That's
But you point out that that's not exactly right. The colonial masters in Nigeria are just about ready to give up colonial domination. Tacker's friends couldn't go into a white club with him. I mean,
well, they didn't get the choice seats, right? They go to the Lebanese restaurant, and they're told that the seats they want are being reserved. And the really most outspoken one of those young men is a Marxist, and he won't have anything to do with being given the back seat in the restaurant. But that has to do exactly, as you said, with colonialism and nationalism or nationhood. I mean, in other words, they're Europeans, they're British, right? And these men are Nigerian. It's not about color.
Mm.
It's not about color. No Nigerian will describe herself or himself as black. There's no that right. They're Europeans. They're colonialists. They're given privileged seats or the better seats in this Lebanese restaurant
because they're
colonialist,
not because they're white.
No, not because they're white.
But now, if as you describe, in some cases in the villages, when a white person appears, there's a lot of what's the word that they shout out?
Oyibo.
Yeah, Oyibo. Oyibo.
Yeah. Oyibo. Actually, I was just in Atlanta at Acapella Books, and a Nigerian friend was there, and he corrected me and said, it's not so much whiteness as it is just that you're different.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You're different. So it's not really so much about the whiteness. Yeah. So differences are certainly noted.
You could be black, but not blackness.
But not, in other words, not a native.
Right.
Not a Nigerian.
No, I think we understand that.
Yeah.
If you joined us late, I'm visiting with Elaine Neal Orr. She's a professor at North Carolina State University and the author of her second novel, Swimming Between Worlds. She and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Elaine Neal Orr, author of Swimming Between Worlds. Elaine, for anybody joined us late, you're a professor at North Carolina State University. This book is set both in Nigeria and in the southern United States, that is in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, in the late 1950s and 1960. Like some of the characters in your book, have had experience both in Nigeria and in Winston-Salem.
Yes. Yeah.
Now, we've talked about Tacker, the high school football player star and architect who's spent time in Nigeria and had a complex experience there. And you're telling me that he's not the only character we should be talking about.
Right. So, there are these two others.
You want to tell Kate tell us about Kate.
So Kate was 2 years behind Tacker in high school, and so that was a gulf back then, right, when you're young. She's a studious type, and she went to Agnes Scott College. But what's defining her life when the book opens is that her mother has died, and her father died when she was a girl in a riptide off the coast of Ocracoke. And so she's an orphan now in her beautiful home in Winston-Salem. And so she and Tacker have both been traumatized, but in different ways. She's distantly connected with the Haynes family.
So, she's got that connection. He's just a college professor. Is that right?
Her father is just he teaches at Salem College. She has a connection with the Haynes family. So she's got a little more of that moneyed sort of connection than Tacker has, whose father owns two groceries in Winston-Salem. And part of what drives the tension in the novel is that these two are attracted to one another, but they have different responses to the civil rights movement as they begin to see it emerging in their town.
How so? Anybody who's been listening to this knows that Tacker's been in Nigeria where he had a opening up experience.
Right.
He's more on the equality side.
Right. He's been transformed by going overseas and being treated as an equal and then coming back home to Jim Crow South and seeing that there's just no reason for it. He can't understand. Mm-hmm. He's been sitting down with these Nigerian guys, not just in restaurants, but anywhere, right? On the road, everywhere they are together, eating together. And she has never experienced anything like that. And she's, I guess, typical in the sense that she doesn't understand why people need to mix, right? That was a way that it was put, wasn't it? Why do people need to mix? Why do people need to
We're getting along
eat together?
Fine. Why do
right.
We need
we're
to?
Get, we've dealt with this and we're getting along fine. And she doesn't want to take any more risks either. She feels that she's already at risk, having lost so much. And then there's this young African-American man, and they actually both run into him on the same morning but under different circumstances
at the beginning of the novel. Both are disturbing circumstances and
right.
put into play the different attitudes that your two main characters have about.
Right. So as the novel begins, Tacker's going to work at his father's grocery. It's a November morning, or maybe it's October, and he walks down the street, down First Street, and he hears someone behind him. No, at first he sees something on the sidewalk, and he bends to pick it up, and then he realizes someone's behind him, and it's what was then called a Negro. He sees this young man, a Negro, and he thinks, he can't even understand the word Negro for a moment. He's just sort of rattled, and he doesn't know what to think of this, but they keep walking. It turns out the guy's headed to his store. Well, he goes in, he buys a bottle of milk, and goes back out, and he's accosted. He's beaten up by two white men on the sidewalk. And Tacker, as soon as he hears it, he goes out there and gets pulls these men away from Tacker, from Gaines. And so he witnesses this violence right in front of his store against this young man who's done the worst thing. I mean, the worst thing he's done is buy a bottle of milk in an area of town.
So it's a white area.
It's a white area. He shouldn't have been there. Right. And
so the white guys, what's he trying to prove by coming into our neighborhood and coming to our store?
Right. And they also think that he's looked at this white woman the wrong way. She was on the street, and he doesn't step aside.
The shades of Emmett Till kind of thing.
Exactly. Exactly. And Emmett Till comes up later in the novel, the story of Emmett Till. So Tackard wants to give him a ride home, but Gaines slips out, and Tackard doesn't know where he goes. He just
has he got his milk?
He gets his milk, but he leaves his hat. I don't know if you remember that, and he takes off, and at that moment, Tackard doesn't know if he'll ever see him again. Well, he cuts through the neighborhood and doesn't want to stay on the main streets, and he goes into the alley behind Kate's house, and she happens to be in the backyard raking, and she looks up, and there's this Negro fellow, strong-looking and—
Young black man,
strong-looking and got on a jacket like he— He just doesn't fit. What's he doing in her alley? And he's holding a bottle of milk. And she thinks, I bet he stole that milk. And then she thinks he's going to jump over the fence and come here and assault me, right? And he just looks up at her and kind of gives her a wave or an acknowledgement. And then he kind of disappears into the trees. It's a little bit mysterious. But she's all shaken up, too. So Tacker and Kate are both, and Gaines, are all shaken up that morning. And it makes me think of the Elvis Presley song that Tacker takes to Nigeria for everyone to hear called, All Shook Up. They're all shook up at the beginning of the novel.
Oh, I missed that. I missed that in your book.
Well, no, it just now occurred to me. I was not thinking that when I put that song in the book.
So all these, this is very powerful in your book. It's very powerful. I don't want to say condemnation of the way we were, but that in the back of the mind of every young white girl is that there's a black guy out there who wants to attack me, and I just got to watch out. And this image infects Kate as her boyfriend, as the young man in whom she's very interested, gets deeper and deeper into the civil rights movement. She just has a hard time going because she's 1950s Southern woman.
Exactly. And a few readers have said perhaps they had a little bit of a hard time warming up to Kate because she does have these thoughts. I think we might sympathize with her given that her parents are dead. And she does come along in the course of the novel, though what finally changes her point of view is when a little black boy asks her for a book. She's working at the library, and she's sitting in a drugstore. And it's not about his having a Coca-Cola next to her. He comes in and says—
She can't give him one because it's a white— This is the white library. Go over to the black library.
Exactly.
What's wrong with that?
Right. Well, they have a library. What's wrong with that?
The younger people have a harder time than I did because this is the way it was when I was growing up.
Sure.
And I'm not bragging about that at all, but I am more sympathetic with Kate than younger readers will be.
Would be, right.
It just doesn't work now for somebody to be like that.
Right.
Well, tell us some more about Kate. I love, and here's the, this is off the, I shouldn't go here, but.
Do. Let's
but
go.
Kate, one of the things you talked about, the little young black kid who wanted a book in the library, and she's somehow or another gotten into photography and taking pictures of— she wished she could take a picture of this. But what are you a photographer?
I'm not.
You talked about the magic of the darkroom and the kind of the possible romance that might take place or costing that might— why does she need to be a photographer?
Well, I felt that she needed deepening. When I wrote the first draft, three-fourths of it was from Tacker's point of view and a fourth of it was from hers. And that didn't work. She was because she is less sympathetic at the beginning because she's less progressive and less sympathetic toward Gaines. It would be easy for her to be an antagonist or for us really not to like her. And so I had to deepen her character. She had to become more of an equal with Tacker, someone he could admire and fall in love with. So I needed to give her something. And it was actually my husband's idea to give her a camera.
Is your husband a photographer? He is. So you've been in the dark room.
I don't think he doesn't know how to develop
No longer. When I was a little kid, I did.
Did you do a bit?
Got the dark room, and so when I could smell the chemicals when you described
the
dark room.
I had to depend on a photographer who develops all the time still, and to get all those details.
Well, I would just say, just be careful about being enticed into the dark room. It's a dangerous place for a young woman. Yeah, but this was making her a photographer. Gave you a chance to take us back into time when people did have to go into the dark room to develop their pictures. Not much of that going on right now, but also to humanize her.
It would much to humanize her and give her something that would give her. Provide an avenue for her to see the world differently. One of the early scenes that I like, there are a lot of scenes I like, is when she goes into this old hotel and she's taking pictures of the hotel. She thinks that maybe the newspaper, the journal, will hire her if she gets some pictures of the town, this, you know, of Winston-Salem. And at one moment, she gets the idea of standing in the window looking out, and suddenly she sees someone across the street, and without thinking, she takes a picture, and it turns out it's an African-American woman, and she has this eerie sense that the woman is looking into her, rather than her being having the gaze of the camera. It's being returned, and somehow that camera is giving this woman access to her interior, and she feels mightily exposed in that moment, right?
Well.
And yeah, so that's this early moment of her self-reflection, looking at herself, actually. And I think that if you're an artist, if you're a photographer, if you're a writer, one of the primary things you're doing is looking at yourself. It seems that the photographer is looking at the world. But the world's looking back. And if you're thinking about your art at all, then I think you recognize that it's a form of self-exposure.
All right, I'm just thinking about that. Let's take a break.
Okay.
Joined us late. I'm visiting with Elaine Neal Orr about her recent novel, Swimming Between Worlds. She and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. If you joined us late, you've missed something. I'm visiting with Elaine Neal Orr about her new book, Swimming Between Worlds, and it's such fascinating story and also fascinating backstories about your connection. For those who joined us late, the book is set primarily in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, in the late 1950s and in early 1960 during the Civil Rights Movement, but a lot of influence from Nigeria. And Elaine, as she's described, grew up in Nigeria and in the southern United States. So all of this wonderful background leads to the enticement of the young male hero, Thacker, into the civil rights movement in Winston-Salem, into the sit-ins. He's a typical southern boy working in a grocery store. How's he going to get involved in the civil rights movement? How are you going to get him involved in the civil rights movement?
Well, the primary way was to get him into a black country and back. Mm-hmm. So he goes to Nigeria and he falls in love with Nigeria. But he also then is treated unjustly, right? So he has a different kind of experience with black people. And he experiences injustice himself. So when he comes home and he's confronted with Jim Crow and a Negro man is beaten up outside his father's grocery one morning, he's a prime candidate. He's someone who could be compelled more than enticed, compelled by his conscience to join up with Gaines Townsend, the African American. He eventually, the man with the milk, the milkman, that he eventually hires to work in his store. And Gaines starts leaving for lunch and going out just for an hour. He doesn't tell Tacker what he's doing. And then one day, Tacker says, well, you can't keep leaving the store. What's up? And he says, we're sitting in at these lunch counters and we're making history and you should come. And so Tacker has this Indian motorcycle and they get on it one day and he leaves his assistant manager, who's a woman, at the store and he goes. And that's an actual sit-in that I used. And the probably the most famous sit-in in Winston-Salem, which was organized by some Winston-Salem State students and Wake Forest College students. And they walked in side by side to the Woolworth at 4th and Liberty in Winston-Salem and got arrested. And so that's the scene I use. I put my characters in that scene.
This is sort of the most – is a very interesting part of the book for me because in 1960 I was we were beginning to feel and to understand that our social system had to change. And the question was, were we going to be on the front lines or just kind of watch it? And for those of my friends who were courageous enough to do what Thacker did and participate, they paid a heavy price, at least initially, in terms of nobody's going to invite them to the country club.
Right. Nobody's give That's them what Kate's a, worried about.
Nobody's going to give them the right kind of job, not because they don't appreciate what he did, but our clients and our customers would not go along with it, that there was a heavy risk. 10, 15, 20, 30, 50 years later, these people are heroes because they took the steps that Thacker took.
So right. And he's weighing all of that. He wants to have his architectural career. Yeah. Is he going to get hired in his hometown if he shows up downtown causing a ruckus? And he's thinking exactly that.
Well, he's thinking exactly right because, again, as a lawyer hiring people, he's so interested in civil rights. We love that, but our clients
right.
would—
And that's what his father says, right, at the grocery. We have to be careful. This is our livelihood, and it is. It's yeah. their bread.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I thought that was— very nicely, poignantly described the pressures, the counter pressures, and we can't give away the ending, but your main character Thacker does ultimately make it's a compromise commitment, but it's a pretty strong commitment to the civil rights movement.
Yes,
you got him over the hump, right?
Yes, yeah, yeah, he does. He's presented with an opportunity to further his career, and he really, really struggles. Again, we can't give it all away. He really struggles. The reason there's a swimming pool on the cover is he's offered the opportunity to design a bathhouse for a pool in Haynes Park, and it's a plum. He wants it. He wants it. What's he going to do? Because he's just gone to the sit-in.
Well,
now is he going?
He's
gone to the sit-in. Now he would be helping to build, to literally
it's
build.
It's going to be a segregated
pool. Yeah. And so, and anybody who's paid much attention to the civil rights movement knows that the pools were maybe one of the biggest hurdles. There was so much stigma about black men and white women being in that intimate space together. And so the lunch counter sit-ins were a big deal, but the swimming pools were bigger.
It's harder.
Yeah.
All right. Now, look, great book and more fun talking to you about it. But what are you going to do next now?
Oh, I'm working on another novel,
and is it going to be set in two worlds?
Of course. Of course, yeah. It's going to feature a woman who's a curator of African art.
in what town?
Well, it's going to be in North – I think it's going to be in North Carolina in a town like Raleigh.
And so she's going to be interested in African art. And
yes, there's going to be a mystery at the heart of this novel. She's already brought into the museum this sort of fabulous work of African art. I don't have time to describe it to you. And something mysterious occurs with it.
Oh, well.
It. Yeah, it's going to be full of mystery and magic and maybe some of that Suzanne Winger stuff that you want more of.
The White Witch.
Well, just real mystery.
Well, that is, we're out
this
of time.
Object.
But that is a great part of your book, is the conflict between cultures. And when you get a real interesting person who's really conflicted, it's just wonderful.
Thank you. It's been great to talk.
Thanks for a great book. Thanks for sharing it with us. Our guest has been Elaine Neal Orr. Her book is Swimming Between Worlds. Thanks to you for listening. This is D.G. Martin. I'll be back here before you know it.